verses 12 to 27, which is on the screen. So the band of soldiers and their captain and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him. First, they led him to Annas, for he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was high priest that year. It was Caiaphas who had advised the Jews that it would be expedient that one man should die for the people. Simon Peter followed Jesus, and so did another disciple. Since that disciple was known to the high priest, he entered with Jesus into the courtyard of the high priest. But Peter stood outside at the door. So the other disciple who was known to the high priest went out and spoke to the servant girl who kept watch at the door and brought Peter in. The servant girl at the door said to Peter, "You also are not one of this man's disciples, are you?" He said, "I am not." Now the servants and officers had made a charcoal fire because it was cold, and they were standing and warming themselves. Peter also was with them, standing and warming himself. The high priest then questioned Jesus about his disciples and his teaching. Jesus answered him, "I have spoken openly to the world. I have always taught in synagogues and in the temple where all Jews come together. I have said nothing in secret. Why do you ask me? Ask those who have heard me what I said to them. They know what I said." When he said these things, one of the officers standing by struck Jesus with his hand, saying, "Is that how you answer the high priest?" Jesus answered him, "If what I said is wrong, bear witness about the wrong. But if what I said is right, why do you strike me?" Annas then sent him bound to Caiaphas the high priest. Now Simon Peter was standing and warming himself, so they said to him, "You also are not one of his disciples, are you?" He denied it and said, "I am not." One of the servants of the high priest, a relative of the man whose ear Peter had cut off, asked, "Did I not see you in the garden with him?" Peter again denied it, and at once a rooster crowed.
Great. Thank you. Thank you so much, Philip. We're going to carry on this series in John's Gospel, the lengths to which love will go. And we're working through this Gospel all the way down through to Christmas. And it'd be great if you could have that passage open, because we're going to be looking at it now together. The idea that we can be whoever we want to be, just live your dreams, it's become something of a cliche. Our children often joke, if I ask them, you know, what was that film or program, what was the message of it, they often say, "Oh, same as always, Daddy, live your dreams." But it's not just a caricature. This really is an explicit and dominant message in our society today, isn't it? Even this week, I was watching Christopher Jackson being interviewed about his role in the musical Hamilton. And he said, "My granny used to consistently remind me that I could achieve anything that I wanted to. You could even be in the White House," she said. And he said, "And it's true. Look at me. I've followed my dreams and I've sung in the White House." You can do it. You can do it. That's the message we constantly get told. And there's something very positive about this message. It does help children raise their sights, doesn't it? Which, of course, can be a very good thing. But what I want us to think about today is that there is a big problem when we carry this "you can do it" principle over into how we relate to God. And actually, the spiritual version of this "you can do it" mentality is very common in churches. It may be especially popular in churches like Grace Church that take the Bible seriously, take discipleship seriously. In fact, the more radical the demands are, the better it is for many people, because one thing that keen and zealous people love is a challenge. And even if the church never teaches this directly, often people assume, don't they, that this is the underlying message. Come on, lift your game. You can do it. You can do it. And I want us to think today about what about when we discover that we can't do it. What about those moments when we discover that our best is not enough? So inevitably moments come, don't they, when we just hit a reality checkpoint. There's something which knocks us for six. Maybe we fall into a particular sin which shocks us. Or maybe it's an old problem we thought we'd left behind and we're discovering actually we're not as strong as we thought we were. Maybe it's just exhaustion. Here I am trying to serve Jesus, trying to keep all these plates spinning, but I don't think I can keep this up anymore. I can't do it. And in today's passage, which Philip just read, Peter hits one of these reality checkpoints. And as we're going to see, that painful though it is, it's actually a crucial discovery for him. And in time, it will do him a great deal of good. It will open the way towards true fruitfulness for him. What we're looking at today, I think, is a crucial lesson for all of us, especially if we want to know how to relate to God, if we want to be fruitful in this life, which I guess we do. Now, it's the night before Jesus dies, and our passage today ends with a rooster, a cock, crowing, which immediately takes us back to a conversation earlier that evening. So back in chapter 13, Jesus was talking about how he was going to return to the Father. And he tells the disciples that they won't be able to follow him. And Peter says to him, I've got the words there on the screen, Lord, why can I not follow you now? I will lay down my life for you. So Peter's saying, look, just tell me how high, Jesus, and I'll jump. I will do whatever it takes. I can do it. And at one level, it sounds brilliant, doesn't it? You can imagine this kind of person, the Peter sort of person, walking into church, and surely they would be fast-tracked through all the training programs. They'd be sent off to translate the Bible in some remote tribe, and you'd think, oh, what a hero, go get him. That's the kind of person we need more of. But Jesus can see that there's something seriously wrong here in Peter's attitude. And so Jesus deliberately tries to undermine Peter's self-confidence. And Jesus replies to him, verse 38, Jesus answered, will you lay down your life for me? Truly, truly, I say to you, the cock will not crow till you have denied me three times. And in particular, Jesus wants to show Peter, and this is the first point today, that the raw commitment route, as I've called it, is a dead end, spiritually speaking. This approach that the Christian life is mainly about what I do for Jesus, I'm going to lay down my life for you, Jesus, that approach just won't work. But actually, it doesn't look like Peter takes Jesus's correction on board. And the next time we come across Peter, we actually looked at this passage last week, if you're with us, We discover Peter is all guns blazing. He's full of this raw zeal. He's pulling out his sword to defend Jesus from arrest. I can do it. And perhaps Peter's thinking, well, Jesus clearly doesn't think I'm committed enough. I'll show him. I'm going to raise my game. I will show just how zealous that I really am. And this is how the mindset works, the raw commitment route of discipleship. Whatever the preacher says, whatever we read in the Bible, we interpret it through this grid of, well, clearly I just need to try harder. And even though after Peter pulls out his sword, Jesus rebukes him again, Peter, we discover, is, and this is true to his character, he's still undaunted. He's still following through with his plan. And that is where we pick up the story in today's passage. So at the beginning of our passage, Jesus was arrested. He was bound. He was taken to the high priest's palace for interrogation. But Peter is adamant, even if the other disciples, you know, disperse and they're too weak to follow, I'm going to stick with Jesus even to the very end, if that's where it goes. And so with the help of a very well connected disciple, who's almost certainly the gospel writer, John, Peter goes after Jesus into the high priest's courtyard. And we pick up the story now in verse 17. The servant girl at the door to the high priest's courtyard said to Peter, you also are not one of this man's disciples, are you? He said, I am not. This is a low moment for Peter. Despite all of his previous bravado, when the moment actually comes, he bottles it and he denies his Lord. And he does it in front of a mere servant girl. And it's a big hit for him. It's a big anti-climax. Now, we're going to continue in a moment, but let me just give a little sidebar here. For those who have studied Mark's gospel, maybe you've done it in a small group here at Grace Church. And if you've done that, perhaps like me, as I was looking at this passage this week, you were thinking, I know this passage. This is covering exactly the same episode as Mark covers in Mark's gospel. And the truth is, it is covering the same episode. But as it took me quite a while to realise this week, John, who's writing this account, is using a different lens, hence the photo, the illustration there. He's looking at the incident through a different perspective, and he's not making the same point from this episode as Mark does in his gospel. So in Mark's gospel, chapter 14, after Peter makes his assertion that even if I must die with you, I'll never deny you, Mark explicitly adds, and they all said the same, all the disciples. So in Mark, Peter is representing all the disciples. And the episode is there to show that if even Peter, the best of the disciples, if even he is unable to remain loyal, then all of us, all of humanity needs a miracle, an unblinding, before any of us will be able to follow Jesus. And if you know Mark, he's the one who says, what is impossible for man is possible for God. God grants that miracle. But here, John is using a different perspective, and he's making a different point, because the other disciple, John, is with Peter throughout these temptations. John is known to this slave girl, and therefore he's almost certainly already known as one of Jesus' disciples. And John doesn't deny that fact like Peter does. And then John alone records, out of all the gospel writers, that John lasts right through. He's present even at the foot of the cross, where Jesus, in chapter 19 of John, instructs John to care for Mary, Jesus' mother, after Jesus has gone. So in John's gospel, Peter is not representing everyone. It's not that John says that, you know, nobody could ever stay loyal. No, in John's gospel, Peter is representing a particular approach to discipleship. That's why I called it in the heading, the raw commitment approach. So that will help you sidebar over if that's irrelevant and you don't know Mark. But if you do know Mark, this is a little caution not to assume that all the gospel writers are always making the same point from the same episode. They're not. We need to read carefully. Okay, so let's keep going, and let me give you the next bit of text, verse 18. Now, the servants and officers had made a charcoal fire, because it was cold, and they were standing and warming themselves. Peter also was with them, standing and warming himself. Now, technically, the narrative at this point, the story couldn't it, jump straight down to verse 25. It could carry on with Peter's story uninterrupted. But instead, this Peter story gets paused, and we get an account, the camera switches, and we get an account of Jesus facing his own interrogation. And part of the point, when Bible writers do this, you know, press pause, switch to another scene, then come back like this, is to invite a comparison between Peter and Jesus. So as we read it, let's consider this contrast between them. Verse 19. The high priest then questioned Jesus about his disciples and his teaching. Jesus answered him, I have spoken openly to the world. I've always taught in synagogues and in the temple where all Jews come together. I've said nothing in secret. Why do you ask me? Ask those who have heard me what I said to them. They know what I said. So unlike Peter, who crumbles under a simple question from a servant girl, Jesus not only stands up to this interrogation, but you can see there he's pushing back. And he turns actually the interrogation light, he turns it back onto his questioners. So Jesus can see here that his accusers have not got a case. They don't have any specific charge to bring against him, let alone any witnesses against him. And so their only strategy here is to try and wear him down and eventually to try and trap him in his words, get him to say something politically volatile. And Jesus calls them out on it. And he says, look, why are you doing this? Why are you arresting me at nighttime and interrogating me? Everything I've said in the daytime, publicly. And you could have questioned me at any time. This, what you're doing is actually unlawful. And you can tell Jesus' comment has touched on a bit of a raw nerve because of what happens next. Verse 22, when he, Jesus, had said these things, one of the officers standing by struck Jesus with his hand, saying, is that how you answer the high priest? And again, there's another contrast going on here. If you were with us last week, you remember Peter attacks a servant of the high priest in verse 10. But here it's the other way. Jesus is assaulted by a servant of the high priest. And yet Jesus still stands his ground. I can't imagine what this is like. Once your hands are tied, surely, you know, being struck is a very traumatic thing to go down. You can't even block yourself. And yet, despite this physical violence, Jesus courageously uses the opportunity to challenge them again. Look at verse 23, or I'll put it on the screen. Jesus answered him, if what I said is wrong, bear witness about the wrong. This is at the bottom of the screen. But if what I said is right, why do you strike me? So this is actually the culmination. This is the final moment of an ongoing confrontation that Jesus has had with the leaders of the Jewish people throughout this gospel. And this is Jesus' final word to them. And it's an appeal to his opponent's conscience, really, to re-examine their opposition to him and to repent. And then in the final few verses of our passage, the camera switches back again to Peter. And we see Peter give a very different response from Jesus to the question Peter's asked. So let's pick up from verse 25. Now, Simon Peter was standing and warming himself. And that's just to reintroduce his context. So they said to him, you also are not one of his disciples, are you? Peter denied it. And he said, I am not. And this is twice now we've had the same words. Verse 17, I am not. Verse 25, I am not. And I take it these two statements are deliberately meant to echo the two I am statements of Jesus in verse 6 and verse 8 that we looked at last week. If you're with us, in that context, it was a moment of real courage. Jesus was saying, you know, he was standing up like Spartacus and he's saying, I am the one you are looking for. Let these people go. It's a beautiful moment. And yet here, Peter's statements, I am not, they're the opposite. They're showing just total cowardice. I am not one of the disciples. And we see the contrast going on here. Jesus acting for Peter's good, even as Peter denies him. Let's keep going. Verse 26, one of the servants of the high priest, a relative of the man whose ear Peter had cut off, asked, did I not see you in the garden with him? Peter again denied it. So that's the third time. And at once a cock crowed. And we've already seen, haven't we, the cock crowing is meant to take us back in our minds to chapter 13, to Jesus' prediction that we saw. Will you lay down your life for me, Peter? Truly, truly, I say to you, the cock will not crow till you have denied me three times. And this whole episode, we discover, has been to teach Peter just one crucial lesson. And he's learning it the hard way. The raw commitment route is a dead end. It really is. The Christian life is not mainly about us laying down our lives for Jesus. That's been a painful lesson for Peter. It's about Jesus laying down his life for us. And we get a sense of just how painful this lesson is. How much anguish Peter goes through when we come across him next. If we flip forward, we won't do it now, but to chapter 21 after Jesus' resurrection, it's actually around another charcoal fire to make the connection. And we're told that just the memory of this event grieved Peter. It cut him to the heart. But part of the pain of this event was completely necessary. Jesus was deliberately knocking down his idols of self-sufficiency. And Jesus does it so that he does it for all of us in different ways, knocks down the things we're depending on, so that we transfer all of our confidence off ourselves and onto Jesus. As you know, there's only space for one hero in the Christian life. And that hero is not Peter, it's not us. That hero is the one individual who never crumbles under pressure, the one who never resorts to self-protection or self-serving, the one who goes bravely to his own death in love and service of others. That he is the hero. Jesus is the hero we desperately need. And whilst it can be a painful realization, as we've been seeing, that the raw commitment route is a dead end, wonderfully, the great news of this passage, and this is what we're going to spend the rest of the time on, is that thankfully, Jesus laid down his life for failures. Failures like Peter, failures like us. And actually, the heading over this whole passage, I've saved it until the end, but it was near the beginning of our section. It was back in verse 14. And I'm going to pick up the story and we're going to get from verse 12 as we get to it. So from verse 12, so the band of soldiers and their captain and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him. First, they led him to Annas, for he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was high priest that year. Here we go, verse 14. It was Caiaphas who had advised the Jews that it would be expedient, or it would be better, as it's translated in verse chapter 11, it would be better that one man should die for the people. And John is deliberately referring us back here to the place in chapter 11, verse 50, where Caiaphas first made this statement. And in that context, Caiaphas, this high priest, was just giving a political opinion about how he thought Jesus was too powerful and how he thought it'd be better to bump Jesus off than to risk him becoming the focus of an uprising. You know, it'd be better if he died than, you know, we all got into trouble with the Romans. But John goes on to explain that Caiaphas spoke better than he knew. And that, here it says in chapter 11, and that being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the nation, and not for the nation only, but also to gather into one the children of God who are scattered abroad. So do you see the point? Unknowingly, Caiaphas was actually declaring what Jesus' death was really all about. He was prophesying without knowing it. The language that he used of dying for the people, whether he intended this or not, but it's actually sacrificial language. It's language from the temple about how animals die for people. And so as Caiaphas declared, Jesus' death, it's not a meaningless injustice. Jesus' death is a purposeful, sacrificial death. Jesus is the Lamb of God, laying down his life for us. And for Peter, for all of us who like Peter are failures and who don't have what it takes. And this is wonderful, wonderful news. You see, the you can do it mentality, it sounds great, doesn't it? It sounds so liberating. You can do it. It sounds liberating for a while as we puff our chests out and tell ourselves how great we are. But actually, God knows and he longs for us to know true freedom. And he knows that true freedom comes from admitting the truth. The truth is that we can't do it. The raw commitment route really is a dead end. It just won't work. Jesus says we can't follow him to the place where he's going on the basis of us laying down our lives for him. It just doesn't work that way. We can only come to the Father through Jesus laying down his life for us. Back in 2018, England had a World Cup match against Colombia. It was a big moment for English football fans, it was the first time our nation had ever won a penalty shootout since, well, that was the point, we'd never ever won one. It was a big moment. And there you have it. I've put the picture up. In one moment, you had Eric Dyer, the England number four, and you see him there with his brow furrowed, knowing that if he misses this penalty, he really will be a public outcast. Probably 20 years from now, he'll be in counselling, reliving this moment. It will haunt him in his nightmares. Just this incredible pressure on one person. And he stands at the top of that penalty area, knowing that everything depends on him. And if, like me, you were watching that match, you know, for many of us, it was just too stressful even to watch him. We were kind of watching through our fingers, especially if we've lived through the last few decades of missed chances. And now I'm going to cut and put another picture. And this is 20 seconds later. And here we have Dyer fist pumping with a grin that fills the entire screen. He's being mobbed a few seconds later by his teammates. He ends up under this just big pile of ecstatic bodies. And those two freeze frames that I put there, the first one with his furrowed brow, the next one with his beaming smile, I think that really captures the difference between the two approaches, the difference between the you can do it, raw commitment, everything depends on you approach, and then the second picture, the Jesus has done it all, it's finished, just enjoy it approach. Only, of course, in real life, none of us are Eric Dyer. None of us can actually take the shot. The difference in real life is that, you know, we're going up to take the shot and we've got as much chance of scoring as a toddler does. But you see, the world runs by the principle of you can do it. Everything depends on what I do. I have to make the shot. And what's more, as Peter demonstrates here, it's not just a pressurized system, but it's an impossible system. Peter shows us it's not a shot that we can score. We just can't live the life that God calls us to live. We can't follow through. And so it's wonderful news for us that Jesus frees us to live another way, a way that depends not all on us and our performance, but all on Jesus and his. He has done it all. We can share in Jesus's victory. We get to be, in this scenario, the England teammates enjoying Dyer's shot, his victory on our behalf. That's our role. We just cheer and celebrate with him. So I hope we can see that the Bible is not mainly, well, it's not at all about a God at the top of a ladder, barking down the ladder. Come on, climb. Come on, climb. You can do it. That is impossible anyway. The message of the Bible is the opposite. The message of the Bible is about a saviour who has come right down to the bottom, and he's come onto a cross, the lowest you can get. And he's now declaring to the world, it is finished. I've done it all. It is finished. Come and celebrate. And for you and me, that means that when we fall into a sin which shocks us and we discover that we're not nearly as good as we thought we were, of course, we're sad by that. Of course, it's sad when we displease the God we love. But it's not devastating. You see, my eternal future was never resting on my performance today anyway. It was always resting on Jesus's. And that means that when we're brought low by our circumstances, when we realise we don't have what it takes to make life work, that no one's going to invite us to perform in the White House, or at number 10, or whatever your dream is. Jesus liberates us then to be okay with not being okay. We don't have to pretend to ourselves or to anyone else that our lives are a roaring success all the time. Because the gospel tells us Jesus has laid down his life for failures like us. So we're safe, the pressure's off, the future's secure, and we know it's going to be glorious. Ultimately. Now we could leave it there. But of course, for John's first readers, as they're reading this account or hearing it, they know the end of the story. They know that this is not Peter's final scene. This isn't just a random person who's being brought low in this episode. This is Peter. This is the one who was later reinstated by Jesus and who became the head of the church. They all know who he is. Everyone knows how this story's going to end. And so there's actually a deep irony because this same Peter who learned the hard way that the Christian life is not mainly about laying down his life for Jesus, the time will come when Peter will lay down his life for the Lord Jesus. In fact, Peter's specifically told by Jesus in chapter 21:19 that he will lay down his life for Jesus in martyrdom. He'll give his life, literally. But the point is that that can only come later. Do you see the point? Whatever Peter is thinking that following Jesus is fundamentally at root about what I do for him, Peter is not ready. He cannot be used by Jesus. In fact, when in chapter 21, he's commissioned by Jesus to pastor Jesus' flock, what qualifies Peter to do that? It's not that by chapter 21, he's jumped through some more hoops or he's done a bit more theological training or whatever it is. What qualifies Peter is that by chapter 21, he has denied Jesus three times and he's discovered he is not the hero he thought he was. And he's also discovered that wonderfully, Jesus came for failures and not for heroes, and that Jesus has died for him anyway. And that is the key. It's when that lesson has started to sink into Peter's soul that he's not a hero, he's just a forgiven sinner. Nothing more, nothing less. It's only then and only then is he ready to be useful, ready to lay down his life in service of Jesus. And I think this is such a crucial, fundamental principle for us in the Christian life. There is a kind of hero mentality amongst lots of us Christians. You know, we a bit like Peter's raw commitment, just tell me how high and I'll do it kind of attitude. And the reason I recognise this kind of attitude is because I know how easily I can slip into it. Perhaps you can too. It's the attitude where the Christian life is basically about me being committed. It's about me being zealous and disciplined. And this attitude is possibly most common in those in Christian leadership because it's seen to be the keen attitude. And you can spot it because it's often linked to a brittleness. It's linked to a sense of insecurity. I wonder if some of Peter's zeal in chapter 13 was inspired by having just seen his friend Judas drop out of the race. And Peter wants to show that unlike Judas, he has what it takes. And this attitude is often characterized by a lack of generosity to those less keen than us. We get annoyed when people don't pull their weight or, you know, who don't make it to the workplace Christian meeting or are less sacrificial in their giving or who don't accept certain challenging doctrines the first time they hear them. Forgetting, of course, that for us, it was probably decades before all of this started to click into place for us. And it's also linked to seeing things in life as very black and white. So whether someone gets involved in this ministry at church, which I think they should do, is basically an obedience issue. Do they love Jesus or not? That's the question. And when we have this hero mentality, we can even end up doing Christian service. We can end up sharing the gospel with someone. We can end up teaching someone the Bible, not out of love, but basically out of pride. Here are some people made in God's image, and yet they've just become another scalp or, you know, another trophy. They've just become another person whom we can use to build our empire. And so it goes on. And of course, when we sense this tendency rising up in us, this you can do it, it's very ugly, actually. When we sense that we are becoming Peterish, what do we need to do? Well, I hope we've seen it already. We need to go back and relearn the lesson that Peter had to learn that night. It's a painful lesson. The Christian life is not mainly about me laying down my life for Jesus. It's mainly about Jesus laying down his life for me. The raw commitment really is a dead end. And yet, thankfully, Jesus laid down his life for failures like me. And of course, as we learn to return day by day to this reality, something happens. And there's a new energy, there's a new power. We can finally lay down our lives, as Peter eventually did, not as raw commitment, but for a whole different reason. We can start laying down our lives for Jesus as a heart response to the kindness that we've been shown. I've mentioned before, because it's been very significant for me, but the guy who runs the camps, the activity holidays that I was involved in for lots of years, I asked him before I started working for a church if he had any good advice for me for doing Christian ministry. And he said this, and it stuck with me. He said, "Let serving others always be an overflow." And I didn't get what he meant. And I asked him, and he said this: "You can only serve others out of the overflow of what you are receiving from the Lord. So make sure you keep going back, keep receiving God's grace day by day. Keep remembering that before anything else, you're a forgiven sinner, nothing more. And then let serving others always be an overflow of the love that God is showing us." I'm going to leave a moment for reflection. Consider what the Lord is saying to us through this passage. And there's some coffee questions on the sheets if that's a help to you. Let's have some quiet now before the Lord, before our prayers.